All right, who's on the Lord's side? Let's figure out what we have from the book of Romans, chapter 14, verse 12.
So then each one of us will give an account of himself to God. Is that right?
Yes, it is. And our blank, page 2, question 2, there towards about three-fourths of the way down, every one of us shall give an account. A day is coming where we will give a reckoning to God. You may remember from Matthew 25, it's about verse 31, I believe, that Jesus talks about returning at the end of time. He's going to separate the sheep from the goats. And there's going to be an accounting, there's going to be a reckoning for how people have lived. So we can either, we sometimes hear people use the expression, you can pay now or you can pay later. It's your choice. Such is also true in the spiritual realm. All right, then number 3. Let's pick up with 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 6 and 7.
Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time, casting all your cares upon him, so he cares for you.
Okay. Our word that we want to emphasize there would be all. Cast all your cares upon him. Why? Because he
cares.
He cares for you. God's concerned about us. So one of the reasons that we would say we want to be on the Lord's side is because this is going to put God in a position where he can respond to us, where he can help us and give us the things that we need as we go through life. And that's true for the youngest Christian. It's true for the oldest Christian. It does not matter who we are. God cares for his people. So we want to make sure that he is literally on our side. Then number 3, we look at Matthew chapter 10, verses 29, and then also verses 30 and 31.
Are not 2 sparrows sold for a copper coin, and not one of them falls to the ground apart from your Father's will? And then what is it?
Okay, let's answer our question, and then we'll pick up with verses 30 and 31. Thank you. What's our blank? Are not 2 sparrows sold for a farthing, and not one of them? You know, sparrows in this day and time were cheap. People used them for various things, and, you know, they really didn't have much value. And yet Jesus said, God's mindful of them. Now, if you take this and you translate it into life, if you go outside this time of year, you think about all the leaves that are falling. You know, we have had at least some leaf raking, I think, done by people here, or leaf blowing, and get the big pile of leaves. And as you see them, I mean, it's, well, this is kind of a big pile of, you know, junk and waste, and maybe wish we didn't have to do it. But you know, you think God knows how many leaves are in the pile?
Sure.
Yeah. The colors, I mean, everything that you can possibly imagine, how much each one weighs. He knows about every blade of grass, every twig. You look at an ocean, you look at a river, he knows exactly how many ounces are there. There's not a single thing that is outside his knowledge. And this God says, as we saw back from 1 Peter 5, what's he want to do for us? He wants to care for us, help us. He says, I understand, I really, really do. And I want to take care of you in life. And then verses 30 and 31, he illustrates the point. Tina, if you...
But the very hairs on your head are all numbered. Do not fear, therefore, you are of more value than many sparrows.
Okay. Now, again, the sparrow wasn't a creature that had a lot of value, but Jesus, since he's introduced this illustration, said, you are very, very valuable, even to the point where God is mindful of the number of hairs on your head. Anything that you want to add or ask over what we've started with tonight before we pick up with the information on page 3? All right. Looking at the fourth question on page 3, he or God is a constant and abiding friend. Can we pause for a second and just think about what's happened to some of our friends over the years? You know, if you've been alive for at least 20 or 30 years, some of the friends that you used to have, what's happened to some of them? All right. Some friends have died, no longer with us. All right, you're exactly right. There are some, we maybe start off on the same path, or at least we're good friends, and we head down this way, and they decide they're not going to be on the Lord's side. They go down a very different road, and that's sad. What else happens to friends sometimes?
You lose contact with them.
All right, sometimes, you know, even with the technology that we have, internet and good mail system, phones, you know, still we just lose contact with people sometimes, and maybe years go by and it's reestablished, and maybe we meet some people, and 20, 30, 40 years later, they kind of come to mind, and we just say, well, you know, we're not sure where they are. Anything else? There's at least one other answer out there, I think, that's worthwhile. All right. And they may not only quit being your friend, they actually become your enemy. You know, it's not just we're on different roads. We're now on hostile sides. But when we think about God, the author points out if we will continue to do God's will, He's going to be our constant. He's going to be our abiding friend. One of the passages that emphasizes this is found in the book of Hebrews, chapter 13, verses 5 and 6. Has someone turned there? Hebrews 13, 5 and 6. Dolores. Okay, let's go back and fill in the blanks based on what she said. Let your conversation or let your manner of life be without covetousness, you know, be free from the love of money, and be content. Be satisfied with the things that you have. Why? Because God said, I'm never going to leave you. Well, doesn't that contrast well or stand a nice contrast to what we just said? Molly gave the answer, sometimes friends die. God ever going to die on us? Nope. Sometimes we go down and lose contact with a friend. But God says, you're never going to lose contact with me unless that's something that you initiate. Sometimes a friend becomes an enemy. But God says, once again, I will never do that to you. If you are willing to cleave to me, God says, I will be like glue. I will stick with you no matter what. And He states it in two different ways. Number one, I will never leave you, nor will I
forsake you.
Can you think of a situation where a person has not been left, but he's been forsaken? What's the difference between the two? I'll never leave you, and I also will not forsake you.
Forsake somebody is just not going on with
them. Oh, okay. It could be used in that sense. So forsake and leave could be used in almost identical ways. But is it also possible to not leave someone, to still be with them, but to forsake them? Okay. That would be one example. What if you've got a stack of dishes in the kitchen and somebody is sitting there? Oh, I'm not going to leave you. But can they forsake you? They can just sit there on the chair, right? They've forsaken you in the sense that they're not helping you. They're present. God could possibly do that. He could say, I'm always going to be around, but I'm going to have a hands-off policy. The needs that you have, forget about them. I'm just going to kind of watch as you grin and bear it through life. Don't expect anything from me. But God says, I'll not only be there, but neither will I forsake you. I will help you because I know your needs. And then He goes on to say, in what Dolores read, we may say how? Boldly say. This is where I think some Christians fail. They might meekly say, or they might quietly say, the Lord is my helper, but they kind of whisper it. Oh yeah, God's on my side. But the Hebrew writer said we should be bold about it, confident about it. The people that he was writing to had come to a point where they had lost, to some degree, their confidence in Christ and Christianity, and the Hebrew writer is trying to strengthen them with his epistle. And then at the end of the verse, I will not fear what man shall do to me. Think it might be possible to have a lot of friends but still fear? Yeah. You might have a ton of friends but still fear what people might do to you. But God says, if you're on my side, don't be afraid. All right, then the last item before we pick up with the next section. Those who are not on His side are certain to be lost. They're not going to be saved. Paul talks about this in the 2 Thessalonian letter, 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, verses 7 through 9, with these words. And to you that are troubled, rest with us when the Lord Jesus shall be revealed from heaven with His mighty angels in flaming fire, taking vengeance, even if we didn't read the verse in advance, we should know it, taking vengeance upon them that know not God and that obey not the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ, who shall be punished with everlasting destruction from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of His power. So once again, God says you can make a choice to obey me in life, you can have me as your friend as you go throughout life, or you can reject me, and the consequence of that is going to be eternal destruction. Bad, bad news. Anything that you'd like to add or ask before we pick up with the next section? Okay. Here he talks about God remembers those who are on His side. So God not only helps people, but God's actually especially mindful of those who choose to be His people. The nation of Israel, and he's pulling here from the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 32, verse 30. Somebody want to go back there and have that ready for us in just a minute, Scott? He says to the nation of Israel, God's chosen people, having made some very, very definite promises. He said He would supply their needs. And God said, I'm going to supply your needs how often? Yearly? Monthly? Weekly? Always. God says, your daily needs, I will supply these things for you. God said he would prosper them in the presence of their enemies. He would cause the enemies to fear them and be defeated by them. He would send blasts, hailstones, hornets, and other frightening and disastrous calamities among their enemies so that they would know the Lord was fighting for Israel. Takes you back to what we said earlier about Hebrews chapter 13, verse 6. I will not fear what men shall do to me because the Lord is my helper. All right, let's pick up the verse, Scott, and then fill in the blanks. Deuteronomy 32, verse 30.
Hearken one of Jake 1,000, and to put 10,000 to flight, unless the rock had sold them, and the Lord had given up on them.
Okay. Our first blank, one of the Hebrews could chase how many?
1,000.
Can you imagine that? One soldier put 1,000 people to flight? But God says, if I'm on your side, how many others do you need? Nobody else, if I'm on your side. And then Margaret gave the answer to the next one. Two could put 10,000 to flight. So, once again, God says, I am a majority by myself. So if you choose to be one of my people, you're always going to be on the winning side, even though it may not always seem like it. Then he goes on to say, picking up from Deuteronomy, is it Deuteronomy 32:10? Okay. I thought that was right. Scott, you want to read that as well?
Yeah. He found them in the desert land, and in the howling waste of the wilderness, he encircled them, cared for them, and kept them in the apple of his eye.
Yeah, this is an expression that's used at various times in the Old Testament. Here you have it. You'd also find it, I believe, in Zechariah chapter 2, verse 8, and at least probably 4 or 5 other verses. What's it mean? God said, you're the apple of mine eye. All right, I think that's going to be a good part of the answer. God says, I'm focused on you.
Special.
All right, special, cherished, honored, very, very important. The expression, as I understand it, also has the sense of a pupil. You know, if you get real close to somebody, you know, you can almost see yourself in the pupil. There's a little bit of a reflection. And it was a figurative way of saying, once again, if you're the apple of mine eye, I cherish you, I love you, you are about as important to me as anything can be. So God said to his people, I will regard you as the apple of mine eye. And also, as you look at the information in verses 13 to 14, Scott, if you want to read these verses as well, some additional information as far as how God would see his people and help them.
He made them ride on the high places of the land, and he ate the produce of the field. And he suckled them with honey out of the rock, and oil out of the flinty rock, curds from the herd, and milk from the flock, with fattened lambs, rams of the Bashan and goats, with the very finest of wheat, and he drank foaming wine made from the blood of the grape.
Okay, let's see if we can fill in our blanks. Cause your people to eat the what? I put in the increase. That was a King James word. You may find a different word in a different translation. But God says there's going to be the increase in the fields. Who's that going to come from? God. So he says, you're going to have that. And then also, you're going to be able to suck honey out of the rock. I think that's literally true. I don't think that's literally true. But it was a figurative way of saying, once again, I'm going to provide for you. I'm going to provide for you in an exceptional way, once again, because you are the apple of my eye. You are very, very precious. And then you're going to feast on the butter of
kine.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, all those. And then you've also got the milk of. Okay, and the fat of? Okay, and then this one is going to vary a little bit too. Drink the pure? Okay, grapes, cup, different things there. What do you think he means by the pure blood of the grape or the cup? You know, grapes aren't bloody. Oh, okay. If you buy grape juice, especially this time of year, how do they market it? They got the big fancy bottle and it's called? Or sparkling. The sparkling grape juice. And I think that's really the idea here. It's going to be the best, the finest, what you get from the greatest harvest. Okay, anything you want to talk about before we pick up with the next section. God has not changed. All right, here, God is just as mindful of us today as he was of Israel in years past. There is more of a focus on spiritual things than secular things, but still, God is no less mindful of us. A lot of people don't believe that when the author says God has not changed. But his will for man has changed. We do have a different testament, but God is still the same God. Matthew 28, verse 20, once again, we should be so familiar with this, we can quote it, or at least fill in the blanks without looking at the passage to the apostles. Jesus said, when he sent them out to preach throughout the world, he says, "And lo, I'm with you how often? Always, forever, even to the end of the world." Matthew 28, verse 20. And then to those who are willing to put him first in all things, he said this in Matthew 19, verse 29. "And everyone that has forsaken houses or brethren or sisters or father or mother or wife or children or lands for my name's sake, he's going to receive a hundredfold." Now, do you think that's literal? Let's put it in these terms. Somebody gives up their house for Christ. Do you think they're going to get 100 houses in return? They can just count them up. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 100. All right. He's using figurative language to go ahead and say God is going to go ahead and respond to you in a great, great way. You're going to be blessed by him. But it's not a literal statement. And then, of course, he tries to clarify that by the next statement there. And shall inherit everlasting or eternal life. All right, before the next section, what the Lord is to those in his sight. Anything that you'd like to contribute? Okay, let's pick up our first three references, get some people lined up for this information. 1 Peter chapter 4, 1 Peter 4 verse 19, Steve, and then from 2 Corinthians chapter 1 verse 3, 2 Corinthians 1, 3, Scott, and then was that Rita or was that... Okay, Glenda. I couldn't quite see which hand that was. Psalm 139, verse 2. Okay, 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 19.
"So then, those who suffer according to God's will should commit themselves to their faithful Creator to continue to do good."
Let's think about God for a second in terms of his being a faithful Creator. What does that mean? Maybe we could look at it first from the standpoint of a God that would be an unfaithful Creator.
He's faithful because he does what he says.
Okay.
He's consistent.
Alright. Always consistent. Consistency, as the old statement says, thou art a jewel, and man is often inconsistent, or at least only partially consistent. But God across the board is always logical, he's always consistent. We can follow Steve's line of thought for just a second, or we can pursue the other line of thought and come back to this. The faithful Creator, what comes to mind? Well, let's look at it negatively for just a second. If God were not a faithful Creator, do you think we'd have some problems? What do we need as his creation to survive on a daily basis? All right, air. All right, what if God decided to be unfaithful? Just say, well, you know, you've had air long enough. I'm just going to cut it off. You know, sometimes people will cut off power for certain times during the day. A government will do that, maybe to make sure that there are no, you know, blackouts. You have rolling blackouts. And God says, well, okay, I'll just take a third of the day. I'll take 8 hours a day and shut off your air supply. Well, would he be a faithful Creator? I mean, you know, unless we had some oxygen tanks, we'd be not in good shape. What else when we think about God being faithful? Scott?
He's faithful to us. Gives man chance after chance. I mean, even when he destroyed everyone's blood, he still saved Noah just to give him just one more chance.
Yeah. When you think about faithful, faithful as far as second chances and third chances and fourth chances. Yeah. There have been literally hundreds, if not thousands, of second chances that God has offered to people. So when you think about his faithfulness as far as his commitment to saving man and giving him hope, he's certainly been faithful there. Anything else? Faithful or unfaithful when we think about God and his being a Creator? Well, what if God says, I'm going to, at times, change up my natural law? Might that pose some problems for us? You know, when we think about people, everybody, unless there's a birth defect, everybody's born in basically the same way. But imagine a Creator that says, well, let's just change it up. Let's give the next generation, you know, one eye that's in the foot, and let's give him six arms. And you have some people running around that are arranged a lot different as far as their anatomy today. Well, it might make things a lot more interesting. but he wouldn't be faithful. What else comes to mind when I think about God being a faithful and faithful creator? You know, when you think about somebody, we have people, Halloween was not that long ago, and people, you know, like to play tricks on people. Can you imagine what our world would be like if God played tricks on people? I mean, we wouldn't know what to expect. Life is already too unpredictable in a lot of ways. But God says, I'm faithful. I have set these laws in place, so life will be predictable for you. You know, even days. Can you imagine, you know, what it would be like if the sun never set? I mean, it's just law after law after law that we live by, and God says you can depend on these things because I'm faithful. Glenda?
When he said, I will never leave thee or forsake thee, I find that I've been felt persecuted against for trying to leave someone the truth. I just remember that verse. So that, to me, is God's faithfulness that I can believe in.
Yeah. Well, and you can relate that to Matthew 28, verse 20, where once again he said, you go teach, and I'm with you always, even at the end of the world. Sherman?
I think the recent example, we just had a election. You know, half the people are happy, half of them aren't. But no matter who's the president, God is still God.
Yeah.
And he is who we need to look up to. And he's faithful to us, and we need to be faithful to him.
Yeah. He doesn't, even with that, he doesn't turn the reins over to somebody else. He says, you can depend on me that I'm always going to be in control of the world. So all these promises, at least they should be very encouraging to us. Then we pick up with 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 3.
Blessed be the God, the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies, and the God of all comfort.
Two more great statements about God. God says, if you need mercy, who do you want to see? You want to see me. Why? Because I'm the Father. I'm the originator. I'm the source of mercy. And then Paul also said, as he wrote this second letter to the Corinthians, God is, as we look at that word all, he says he is the God of all comfort. Well, we need that sometimes. And we talk about getting comfort from people or comfort, you know, because a health issue has been remedied, comfort for a lot of things. But God says, if you need comfort in life, come to me, because this is one of my specialties. Then Psalm 139, verse 2. Dolores? Okay. And we sometimes find it difficult to read people or have some idea what they're thinking. We use the expression, a penny for your thoughts. But the writer of this psalm said, God, even if I'm where? Way over here. Afar off. What do you know? You understand my thoughts. You think we live in a world where a lot of people feel like nobody understands them? I hear that statement as much as anybody. Nobody understands me. Well, maybe that's true from a human vantage point. Maybe mom, dad, siblings, friends, nobody understands. But God says, hey guys, guess who gets it? I do. And I've got the power to help. I have the desire to help. I am the Father of mercies, the God of all comfort, so turn to me. And yet, as we look at our nation, it wants seemingly to turn to any place but God. And that's just really, really perverse thinking, but that's where we are. All right, anybody else before we pick up with the next set of references? 1 Chronicles, chapter 16, verse 34. You'll have a little bit to get there. All right, Molly, and then after that, Exodus 34, verses 6 and 7. Exodus, okay, Scott, 34, 6 and 7. And then we'll head back once again to the Old Testament, Nehemiah 9, verse 17, Brian. Let's pick up with 1 Chronicles 16, verse 34.
Give thanks unto the Lord, for he is good, for his mercy endureth forever.
Wow, here's another comforting passage. Now, we just picked up from the 2 Corinthians letter, chapter 1, verse 3, who's the Father of mercy? God is. Now, we sometimes in life have a great offer. But if you watch the advertisements that are made for the offer, they say it expires when? Tonight. Tomorrow, after the first 500 callers, there is an expiration day. It's not going to go on and on and on. I mean, all offers, practically all the offers in life that we see, have some termination point. But God says, when it comes to my mercy, it's going to be forever. And, you know, that's going to be for the existence of our earthly life. God always offers hope to people in this life. Then in Exodus 34, verses 6 and 7, starts out with an emphasis on mercy and talks about some of God's other great qualities.
Lord, pass before him. God merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and about
steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin. But who will by no means clear the guilty?
All right, let's fill in our blanks. God is merciful and
gracious.
All right, he's gracious. That would be the King James rendering. And in addition to the mercy and grace, he also is long-suffering. He's patient. He waits on and with people. He's abundant in goodness as well as truth. And he keeps mercy for thousands. You think that statement, he keeps mercy for thousands, means that there's a limit? You know, if there are a million people, his mercy wouldn't extend to the million? No, 1,000 was just a way to say, somebody says, well, you know, you have thousands of marbles. Well, that may not be true. What's he mean by that statement, though? You've got a lot. So when God says keeping mercy for thousands, that's a figurative way of saying you keep mercy for everybody. So not a literal statement. And then he says doing what as far as iniquity and transgression?
Forgiving.
God's in the business to forgive. I find that to be interesting and almost kind of odd. People today say, well, you know, you Christians, you believe in God and, you know, you don't believe in forgiveness. You should be kinder and more thoughtful in dealing with people. We do believe in forgiveness. God believes in forgiveness. God's a God of forgiveness. But he's a God of forgiveness when it comes to those who are willing to obey him. So forgiveness is conditional. It's available, but people have to access it in the right way and on his terms. And the end of the verse deals with this point specifically. God will not by any means do what to the guilty?
Clear.
Well, he will not do that unless they have to obey him, which obviously includes repentance and the other things associated with obedience. All right, then we come to Nehemiah 9, verse 17, our next verse.
If you still obey, neither were mindful of thy wonders that thou didst among them, and hardened their necks, and in their rebellion awaited captive to return to their bondage. Thou art a God, ready to pardon, gracious and merciful, slow to anger, and of great kindness, and forsookest them not.
Okay. You ever dealt with a person that you wanted to have them forgive you for something, and they just almost, they make you grovel and almost, you know, beat you to death before you got the forgiveness? Anybody ever had that experience? You say, I'm sorry, and it's just not enough. I'm really sorry, it's still not enough. And you just have to beg and plead and wait and wait and wait. And it seems like the months, maybe years go by and they never forgive you. God, though, says, let me describe how I am. He says, when it comes to pardon, where am I? I'm ready. I'm holding out my hand. You want to be forgiven? You don't have to beg, you don't have to plead, you don't have to wait. God says, I want to pardon you. And not only that, he says, I'm a God who is gracious, I'm merciful. When it comes to anger, what's true of me? I'm slow. I'm patient. He says, he's a God that offers great kindness, and he does not want to forsake people. All right, anything you want to contribute before we pick up with the next two references? Okay, Psalm 23:1. Who wants to be a reader? Psalm 23, verse 1, Scott. And then Psalm 19, verse 14. 19:14, Betty. And then let's just pick up one of the next two references. It's going to be Psalm 18, verse 2. He has here basically the same information. Psalm 18, verse 2. All right, Dolores, I saw you first. Psalm 23, verse 1.
The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want.
Okay, the Lord is my shepherd. I have been waiting and waiting to see something. And finally, yesterday in USA Today, I got to see it. I probably could have pulled it up on the internet. But the Chamber for Congress, I'd been told that there are words at the very top of the chamber. Words about God. And every time that they show that chamber, the area where Congress meets, they always tilt the camera so you can't see it. Now, maybe you're going to see a picture of Congress in the next day, or maybe tonight, and you can say, oh, there it is. Brad, you just missed it. But I've looked and looked over the years, and I have never seen it. And I've heard people talk about the fact that when these guys are in there shooting some video, they always drop the camera down so you can't see it. But in USA Today yesterday, there was a picture of the chamber from apparently a back area. And you could barely see some words. And I kind of knew what to look for. And boy, I mean, I had almost had to get out a magnifying glass. And there it was. In God we trust. Right there in the Hall of Congress. And I thought, well, now with the culture that we live in and God's not the in thing for a lot of people, no wonder they want to go ahead and keep the camera down. But I thought these fellas that claim that they're so offended by that, they're apparently not so offended that they can't go and sit in the Hall of Congress and vote. So really kind of hypocritical. But our society at least does lip service to the idea that God's our shepherd, doesn't it? You go through, I've never been to Washington, but I've done enough reading about it to know that there are religious, you think about the Supreme Court and a lot of the other buildings there, references to God, our currency, references to God there. But when we look at our culture, for a lot of people in the United States, that's a lie. But if we want to be on the Lord's side, who needs to be our shepherd? It has to be God. And that has to be 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. Then Psalm 19, verse 14.
Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my strength and my redeemer.
Okay. Can we see the connection between Psalm 23:1 and Psalm 19, verse 14? If God is our shepherd, then is he not going to be our strength and our redeemer? He is. Those poor little sheep out there in the pasture. You know, if there's something like a bear or another predator that comes up, a lion, who's going to be the strength? Who's going to be the savior? It's going to be the shepherd. And the same is true for us in the spiritual realm. Then Psalm 18, verse 2.
The Lord is my rock, my fortress, and my deliverer. My God is my strength, my rock, in whom I take refuge and trust. He is my shield and the horn of my salvation.
Okay, I put in here, as far as the answer, God is my strength, he's my shield, he's my son, the one that keeps me going, the one that I need. Then let's pick up the next three, Psalm 27, verse 1, Proverbs 18, verse 10. We'll read this one. I'm not quite sure what he was asking for here. I think maybe he put in the wrong verse. But anyway, Proverbs 18, 10, maybe you picked something up from there that I missed, and then Psalm 102, 25 to 27. Who wants to take care of Psalm 27, 1, Scott? Then Proverbs 18, 10. Tina, and then Psalm 102, 25 to 27. Steve. Okay, Psalm 27, verse 1. Scott.
The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid?
Okay, so our blank would be the Lord is our strength. He's, as you mentioned from that translation, he's going to be the stronghold of our life. Today, where do you think a lot of people find their strength or stronghold? If not God, where? I think a lot of people would say, my husband, my wife, my children, my uncle, my aunt, they're my stronghold. They're my strength. Where else?
Financial assets.
All right. You think about the assets that someone has accumulated, especially maybe for a retiree. Social Security is my strength. There would be some people that would look at something like money or property. Anything else? My stronghold. What about physical health? Think there's some people? I can do anything. They do. But all of those things are subject to failure. Proverbs 18:10.
The name of the Lord is a strong tower, and righteous run to it and are safe.
Okay. Anybody come up with a better answer there than strength?
I had strength and safety.
Okay.
Righteous.
Okay. Anybody else? Okay. I can say I'm not quite sure in this one exactly what he was asking. There's no answer key for the book. Psalm 102, verses 25 through 27. Of old thou hast laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of thy hands. They shall perish, but let's get the answer. They shall... Let's go ahead and read the verses. Psalm 102, 25 to 27.
In the beginning, you laid the foundations of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish, and you remain. They will wear out like garments. By clothing you will change them, and they will be discarded. You remain the same, and your years will enter.
Okay, and then a blank. God, you're going to
endure.
I told someone the other day, and I am not sure how this has stayed with us all these years, but I found a pen from the Air Force. If you've ever worked in a government office or ever seen a government pen, maybe at the post office, they're kind of a straight black pen. And after I found that pen, I thought, well, let's see if it still works. It writes as well as it did 30 years ago. I mean, and then I did a little looking on the net, and the Air Force, you know, they overspent on a lot of stuff, and maybe they overspent in the pens too, but apparently these pens were just about made to go up in space and right underwater and just about anything that you could do to make a pen not work. Whoever makes these pens, they figured out how to make them work in just about every set of circumstances. So there are some things that just always seem to last. But for the most part, most things don't endure. The pens that we have, you know, they run out of ink or they break, the little clicker breaks, other things. The clothing that we have, think about in this country, how many shoes and how many pants and how many tops do people go through in an average lifetime? You know, it wears out. If we live to, you know, the old age of 70, 80, you know, 90, just a ton of clothes that will go through. And the Bible uses this image here, also in the book of Hebrews, the first chapter, they're going to wax old like a garment. As a vesture, you're going to change them. The earth is one day going to be destroyed. But the writer says, you are the same. You are, remember what we picked up from Peter? You're what kind of creator? You are the faithful creator. God, we can always depend upon you. We can always rely upon you. There's not going to be anything about you that is uncertain. And thy years shall have no end. Anything that you want to touch base on before we pick up with the next three references? Okay. These will come from 2 Samuel 22, Job 22, and Romans 1. 2 Samuel 22, verse 2, Scott. And then Job 22, verse 25, Brian. And then Romans 1, verse 9. Romans 1, verse 9, Tina. Okay. Let's pick up 2 Samuel 22, verse 2.
He said, the Lord is my rock, and my fortress, and my deliverer.
Okay. Three things. My rock, my fortress, and my deliverer. Well, the people in the Old Testament had great confidence in God. And this needs to be the way that we approach God today. We look at Him. We often refer to this as faith. And this is the kind of faith in God regardless of the circumstance. We believe that He will see us through even when it looks like there is no way to get through something. Job, once again, from what we can tell, a very old Bible character, but he also understood this principle. Job 22, verse 25. Job said,
yea, the Almighty shall be thy defense, and thou shalt have plenty of silver.
Okay, my defense. So there may be some times where it looks like people are not really enthused about us and maybe not supportive of us, but God says, if you're on my side, I will be your defense. You don't need to worry about anyone else or anything else. Then Romans 1, verse 9.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm reading out of the ESV version. Job 22, 25 says, and the Almighty will be your gold and your precious silver.
Okay. I think the idea there still would be when you think about if somebody's got a big stack of gold, what would we normally associate with that? They're going to feel like they're secure, that this is going to be their defense against poverty and other things. So I'm not quite sure why the Hebrew text got translated so differently, Scott, but that would be how I would understand that difference. Then we pick up with Romans 1, verse 9.
For God is my witness, whom I serve with my spirit in the gospel of His Son, that without ceasing I make mention of you always in my prayers.
Okay. Now, if you ever need a witness, what kind of witness don't you want?
A drunk.
All right. You don't want a drunk witness? I mean, did you see that? Well, I don't know. You know? Were you really? I don't know. All right. So you don't want an intoxicated witness. What other kind of witness don't you want?
Blind.
Well, you don't want for the most part, I mean, it could be hearing, but for the most part, you don't want a blind witness. You don't want a false witness, especially if they're testifying against you. All right, you don't want somebody that has a long criminal history, or really any criminal history, because the other side is going to, you know, try to use that in their favor and not yours. What else, as far as a kind of witness, a type of witness you don't want?
Like someone that just agrees with what's going on.
All right. What about the guy who's wishy-washy? Well, maybe, maybe not. Could have been, might not have been. We don't want that kind of witness. When you have a witness, I mean, if this is serious stuff, what kind of witness do you want? You want someone that gets on the stand and says, this is the way it was. I know what I saw. I know what I heard. I know what happened. It happened in this place. It happened on this day. It happened at this particular time. And he gives you all the details, and he's credible. God says, for his people, I will serve as what for you? I'll be a witness. And he's the best witness we can have. So if we choose to be on the Lord's side, this is one of the great spiritual blessings that we have. God will be our witness. James 5:11, and then let's get the other readers lined up. Hebrews 12:29, Exodus 20, Genesis 18, Romans 12:19. Who wants to take care of James 5:11 for us? All right, Carolyn, Scott, I saw your hand flash. Hebrews 12:29, then Exodus 20:5. Exodus 20:5, Glenda, and after that, Genesis 18:25. Genesis 18:25. Lisa, how about you? Genesis 18:25, and then Romans 12:19. Ann, will you get that one for me? Ann, Romans 12:19. 12:19. Let's pick up with our first one, James 5:11.
Behold, we count them happy which endure. We have heard of the patience of Job and have seen the end of the Lord, and that the Lord is very faithful and of tender mercy.
Okay. We have talked about mercy with some of the other references, and that's the answer for the second blank. But God is also... All right, he's compassionate. You know, he understands that we're not going to be perfect people, that we are people who are weak and fail oftentimes, and God says, I take that into account. That's something that I can work with if you have the right kind of heart and spirit. Hebrews 12:29.
Our God is consuming fire.
Okay. If you're not willing to accept God's pity and mercy, then God says option two is what? When we have a chance to visit, I'm going to be like a consuming fire. It's not going to be a pleasant experience. Exodus 20:5.
You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I am the Lord your God, a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me.
Okay. When God says he's a jealous God, that's a way of saying what Jesus talked about in the Sermon on the Mount. If you want to have one foot in God's kingdom and one foot in the world, bad news. It's not going to work. God says there's an exclusive relationship with me. Genesis 18:25 tells us this about God.
Far be it from you to do such a thing as this, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous should be as the wicked. Far be it from you, shall not judge of all the earth.
Okay, what's that about God? When it comes to all the earth, he is the
judge.
He's the judge. Then Romans 12:19.
Dear beloved, avenge not yourself, but rather give place unto wrath, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord.
Okay. If God's people are beat upon or abused at various times, based on what we've said, we've looked at God's people from the perspective of sparrows. Jesus said, you're of far more value than sparrows. You're so valuable, I know the number of hairs on your head. Given those facts and illustrations, if God's people are abused, you think God's going to take action against the abusers at some point? He will. He's going to take vengeance, as Paul promised in Romans 12:19. All right, then let's finish out our next couple of references. Hebrews 4:13. Neither is there any creature that is not manifest, not clear, not visible in his sight, but all things are naked and open unto the eyes of him with whom we have to do. So for the righteous, what they do, what they need to be forgiven of, God sees all those things. When the unrighteous abuses people, when the unrighteous fail to serve God, all these things are known to him. And then in Jude 5:6, I will therefore put you in remembrance, though you once knew this, how that the Lord, having saved the people out of the land of Egypt, afterward, what did he do?
Destroyed
them. Now that's kind of interesting. God saves this nation, and then he destroys them, but God did that because they were unfaithful. He describes it as believe not. And the angels, once again, he created them. They were there in God's presence, but they kept not their first estate. They were not willing to do what was right. They left their habitation, and he's reserved them in what kind of chains? Everlasting chains. They are not going to get a second chance. Under darkness, unto the judgment of the great day. Then he says, in the lessons that follow, we will try to specify just who's on the Lord's side. Are we ready for this?